Do you like conversation on a variety of topics? Feel like no one wants to talk about the things that interest you? Tired of only hearing the same political, sports, or catastrophe talk? Yeah, we feel that way too. Join two high-functioning geeks as they discuss just about anything under the sun. We can't tell you what we'll be talking about each week because we don't know where our brains will take us. It will be an interesting conversation, though, so hang on and join us. Here comes the Relentless Geekery.
I think one of the things that is important to me is that instead of being, so some of what we just talked about is a little bit of jack of all trades and therefore slash master of none, but I don't think it's been that way. I have a number of things that I've become an expert in and that, my gosh, people pay me to do, whether it's coding or writing or speaking or things like that. And so it isn't only that I'm distractible, you know what I mean? That if isn't, I have an interest, and then, oh, shiny, here comes another squirrel, here comes another thing that kind of set me off on another place. It's more, I like going into each of those silos, but I don't stay in the silo. I keep on going to various different other things. And isn't maybe returning to it isn't a matter of, well, I really gave that short shrift last time and learned nothing. I want to be able to have a conversation about it with experts. How much do I need to learn to fake it? No, that's, you know, one of the, I don't think I've been in many situations where I couldn't either add something to the conversation or ask pertinent enough questions that I didn't betray, wow, what a plea, I never, people talk about how they have a little bit of the imposter syndrome or the Cinderella thing, whatever, that you know, I don't know, some part of when you're bright but flighty, you learn to act brighter than you really are. I know that's a weird way to put it, and I've never felt the need to do that. It's always been, I want to be accomplished enough that I can interact with people who I admire, who I really want to kind of be on their list, want to be in the game with them, and so far so good. You know, I've been at Harvard Business Review meetings, and I've been at cosmology presentations at one of the Mesocloquia, and I'm not an expert in all those things, but I sure wasn't, please leave the room, you're embarrassing yourself.
Right,
you know,
right.
So.
and that's a great topic, actually. And I think you've run into this, I've run into this. And a lot of times I don't tell someone I'm in Mensa because there's some stigma attached to it at times. And I think a lot of times it's wrong. You know, people have no problem saying they're a professional athlete or a doctor. And many a lawyer, and you know, the stigma attached to being a lawyer, but they get some respect. But people think, oh, you're in Mensa, you're stuck up, you're too smart for everybody else, and you must know everything. And none of those are true. None of us know everything. But I think the biggest difference is when you're in Mensa with high intelligence, you're very curious, you want to learn, and you know how to learn, you know how to explore, and you know how to put facts together. It's not just memorizing dates and facts and figures. And that's what people think. Well, that refrigerator is broke. You're in Mensa. Shouldn't you know how to fix it? Well, I can look up how a condenser, you know, works, and I can look up how the motors work, and I can probably figure it out, but I've never done it. I don't know how. It's not inherent that you know everything. It's not the omniscient club.
Exactly. If anything, that thing of being willing to say, well, if I had to solve it, how would I? That you have a reasonable systemic approach that it's going to give you. I have often, so let's see, there's a Myers-Briggs thing that has been often discredited, but it's a reasonable thing, shorthand-wise, to talk about the on different axes, what people's instincts are for how they interact with others, how they approach problems. And one of the things is whether you're judging or perceiving, if I remember correctly. And
yes.
And I've had conversations with big judgers that say, I learn things so that I can apply it to a problem that I'm trying to solve. And why would I learn miscellaneous? Why would I learn kind of the trivia of life? And my approach, because I'm more of a slightly more perceiver than a judger, has been, well, if I learn a lot of different stuff, then no matter what problem I bump into, I'm halfway there. I know a little bit about it. I know, kind of can immediately say what's important and what's not, and kind of cut through the solution space to get what are the first things you would try first and have the best chance of success. And so, and I don't know, you don't go on false paths because you know enough about to say, well, that's the amateur way of approaching. Don't just start at A and go to Z. How do you go to like halfway, go to L, you know, A to L and M to Z, and then once you eliminate one or the other, you've eliminated half, not just eliminated one out of 26. So right. I know that's a fragmented way of saying that, but if anything, the love of science, the love of experimentation and hypothesis and testing, and how would you approach problem solving? It pervades my life. You know what I mean? Like, how do I shop? I don't just go to the store and say, oh, the green one, that's pretty. It's like I pop open Consumer Reports and say, okay, based on hundreds of thousands of other people, what's their idea of a good lawnmower? And then I don't have to go and look at every single lawnmower. I get the chance to tap into others, which, wow, another big expansion. Isn't that what being a reader is about? That you don't get one lifetime, you get a million lifetimes.
Yeah. You know? I've lived a million. Going back, you mentioned Myers-Briggs, and that's heck a little bit of a controversy even here in our house. My son constantly is discrediting it, how it's false and, you know, crap and all this. But all I come back with is, let me tell you that I've taken Myers-Briggs several times, and it always comes back with INTJ. And when you read about it, it nails me perfectly. And I introduced it to my wife, and she's an ENFP. And those are like the most two opposite on the 16 that you could have.
Interesting. Exactly.
But once we discovered that and we read this about each other, we suddenly went, oh, that's each of us. Now we knew what to expect a little bit. And honestly, I think it has saved our relationship a little bit, because we'll tell each other, okay, you're being an ENFP right now. Hold on, you know? And so, you know, I it would be very difficult to convince me that that's not at least semi-relevant to people and describing people, even at a, you know, high level. It's, obviously, we are all made up of much more than just four letters that can describe us. But I more often than not, even myself can go, okay, I'm being an INTJ right now. I totally get it. And you can, you know, there can be conflict with that between different personality types. So it's another knowledge thing to help with life.
Exactly. And I don't know, I don't mind those little shorthands. In other words, it doesn't meant to be that it's perfectly predictive and covers all of experience, but I think I've done the same thing to you. Whenever I've taken it, I've been pretty consistent. I'm probably an ENXP. And by that meaning, thinking and feeling are like 51-49 for me. And at one point, it might have been more. It might have been when I was younger, more of a T. But as I've gotten, I don't know, older, more human, more, I know that's a weird way to put it, but I've noticed that my emotions are more towards the surface, whereas, and I value them more than I did when I was young. And so that's, you know, on those other things, because I've been consistent in those scores, that's why I think that it is a reasonable shorthand for me. I know. Yes. I've also seen other things. There's one ocean. You know, OCEAN, and I think it's like, you know, optimistic versus pessimistic, and we're not going into it. That's another one that I think is reasonable shorthand for, if you know that about a person and about how you are, you can immediately see where there might be places of compatibility and places of conflict, and you can use that, not in a straitjacket way, but just in a, I think, and maybe that accounts for a little bit of why we're not only at an impasse, but we're not even able to communicate easily on this. Because we use different terms, and we kind of go down different solution paths and whatever else.
I definitely think a certain way and will present ideas a certain way. And a lot of times when there's conflict between my wife and I, it's because the way I'm presenting it doesn't mesh with how she needs to hear it or receive it. So multiple times we've been able to go, hold on, and let's look at this different. She'll reword it. And I'm like, well, I guess, you know, because that's not how I think. And another one I just learned about was called Enneagram.
I've read those before. Nine different facets, right?
Something like that. Yeah, it's another new one. So there you go. There's our intro. So
this great, perfect geek. Part of being a geek is you examine everything, including yourself. You know, why do I act as I do? Why are these things interesting to me? What are the little, if I had to, like, it's part of what the first thing I wrote for my intro notes, if you will, was I have a thing I've put together that whenever I sign onto a new website and it says, hey, tell us about yourself, the five words that I almost always put are funny, smart, curious, decent, big. And that, you know, that seems, wow, those are not any of them is more than five, you know, six letters, how seven letters, how big, how important can they be? And yet, instead of trying to think of what system that everybody else knows about, I would classify myself at, I think that's a really good thumbnail of me, that I am all of those things. Perfect. And a lot of those, you know what I mean, in a right. big way. And I'm not the opposite, or that I really try not to be the opposite of those things. I don't want to be an incurious person. I don't want to be small about things. And so, I don't know, I think that part of, I mean, the unexamined life is not worth living. Some part of understanding yourself, and when you can see that you're getting frustrated, that you're getting, I'm not making progress. Why is that? Sometimes that ability to step back, or to like have that little monitor over your shoulder, that's listening to what you're saying and saying, is that you? Is that who you want to be? Is that your best self? And then it helps you like in real time. there's a great, I think a French expression called like the ghost on the staircase. And it is when you've been in a conversation, and then as you're leaving the party, you think of, oh, this is what I should have said. and I luckily, and I don't know why, I have a really fast refresh rate. Instead of thinking of that 20 minutes later when it doesn't matter, I often will think of something like while we're having a conversation, if it didn't pop out earlier, it'll pop out in like 10, 15, 20 seconds, and it'll be a little bit like discombobulating, because all of a sudden the word will come out like, well, what does, you know, ants have to do with what we're talking about now? But it's because I have this little guy going through the files in my head, and it came out with what I needed, and quickly enough that it might still pertain, it might still right. help.
So your brain might be working at a quantum processor level instead of just three or five cores or something.
I hadn't thought about that. I know that things, it is amusing to see what my brain does when I'm not aware of what it's doing. Like, right. I'm not consciously thinking of, oh, come on, what's the name of the Silver Surfer's home planet? And then often I've discovered, instead of really gritting my teeth and crying for it, I just go on with other things. And like I said, my little file guys, later on they just say, oh, by the way, that was Zenlaw. You know what I mean?
Yes, all the time.
The fact that we have layers within us and cool conscious, subconscious, unconscious, it's fascinating to me. And then when you can actually count on that, when you count on your mighty brain being able to do cool things, I love that. Yeah. So,
hey, something I was going to bring up. You mentioned in your
ENFP, exactly.
That I guess that fits, because didn't you at least at one time hold the world record for amount of hugs in 1 hour or something?
Yeah, Steve, that's so funny. I really did. You know, we're both in Mensa, and a good friend, Sean Kenny, had looked into what the various different possibilities for the Guinness Book of World Records were that we might attempt. And as you might imagine, if you're in the Smarties Club, it's like, ooh, can you think of the pi to the greatest number of digits, or can you get to a cube root the most quickly? Well, like you mentioned, it's not really what Mensa meetings are about. Mensa meetings are often getting together with your friends, playing games, the conversation ranging wildly, all those cool things. And one of the big Mensa traditions is hugging. You know, really is a great way to just communicate a lot without speaking. It raises your immune response. It just feels great. So he discovered that there was indeed a world record for the most people hugged in an hour. And he was like in the 500s. And we can beat that. And so at the Denver annual gathering, Mensa has an annual gathering where a whole bunch of smarties gather together right around the 4th of July. We put a big notice and make sure that everybody, there's probably 1,500 people at the gathering, and we got everybody in a room within an hour with, you know, appropriate line management and stuff like that. And we broke the world record for that year. And so we were going to be in the Guinness Book of World Records. We had recording going on to prove we could do it. We had gotten all the qualifications from Guinness as to how you had to be able to prove all this. And then, unfortunately, that was in July. And like 2 months later, in Ohio, right here in our home state, at an American Cancer Society benefit, if I remember correctly, somebody else, we beat it with like 833, and then someone got 1,200. They crushed our record.
Wow.
So we never made it into the Guinness Book, which would have been a cool thing for Mensa to have that little bit of that year immortality. I know that's a oxymoron, but you know what I mean?
But
it did turn out that I made it into the Ripley's, believe it or not, manual for that year. They have a big manual annual. And so was a little, hey, I was doing this hug for people in an hour, and they were, I bought a copy so that my mom and dad could be proud of me. Look what your little boy has done. But I think I might have.
I must say, for the geek comic book reader, I think Ripley's beats out that anyway. So
that might be. But actually, if I can add a little addendum to that story. So, you know, so my mom and dad could be proud. Well, I get like two little column inches at the corner of the page. The main picture on that page was the man with the world record for how many cockroaches he could put in his mouth. And so my mom can't stand to go to that page. She doesn't want to see antennae and legs hanging out of this guy's mouth. And so to be humble, I'm reading the same book as cockroach stuffing. So
well, so why isn't there a record for having the most hugs in an hour while the most cockroaches in your mouth? I mean,
oh yes,
you know, just make one
so,
person.
Yeah, the combo would be good because everybody that would have come up to hug you would be to see that and go, and then
right.
Get the 1,200 people with the heebie-jeebie simultaneously.
Well, it has to be 1,201 at least.
Right? That's right, to beat the record.
So, and just also to bring up a little background, you also were on Jeopardy. Which is always a background thing talked about.
I really was. And as you know, that's a big, you know, smarty thing that a lot of people, that's their, it's kind of funny. I don't know that it was always a dream of mine, but I knew that I was good at trivia, so I pursued it. And I was on 5 years ago, and I actually won, which is really cool. You know what I mean? I get to say I was a returning Jeopardy champion. Yay me. And I was no Ken Jennings. I got my butt kicked in the next game. And in fact, I think I had one of the lowest winning totals for that season because we all got Final Jeopardy wrong. And I just happened to have enough scraps left over at the end that I was the guy on top. There was a little bit of calculation as to, you know, make sure that but it was exhilarating and humbling all at the same time because I got tons of correct answers. But then every time that I had a double Jeopardy or a Final Jeopardy, I had butterflies in my stomach. Things didn't come out. That after a while, I realized, boy, you're freezing up. You know, what's that about? You really are usually pretty glib and pretty kind of shameless in what you do. But somehow that is on TV and it's in front of my mom and dad and it's for money and that whole weird combination of it, not just being a goof, like when you go to a bar trivia contest, but that it was actually, it really matters that you can come up with, you know, right. What's.
And see, that was your emotions taking over.
It was. I am ashamed that I couldn't be purely robotically efficient in, you know, stimulus response, giving all the answers. Like I said, I got all kinds of great things, but I kept going up like $7,000, $8,000, $10,000 and then doing a true daily double and losing it. And having to come back from that. And unfortunately, I could only come back so many times. I couldn't pull that trick off. So,
right.
But it was still forever after. I was on Jeopardy. That's pretty cool.
That is definitely a cool badge of honor. The funny thing is, too, because a lot of people think, oh, well, that's you're in Mensa. That's why. But the Mensa test is not Jeopardy questions, is not answering facts and figures at all.
That's
anywhere
right.
In that test.
Exactly. It's not knowledge. It's kind of like brain power. It's an IQ test. So it kind of judges how quickly you think and how quickly you find patterns and those kinds of things. And trivia is a different world than that. The fact that I have a good memory and high intelligence is kind of what gives you that, maybe, you know?
Yes.
The processing of the way that they write questions for Jeopardy, that you'll learn to pick up the significant words. And why is that slightly out of place? Because it's kind of hint, therefore. And so that's, I don't know, I've been in college, I was in College Bowl. And that my first taste of people that really took that seriously. Like they were memorizing things and they were making sure they knew every Shakespearean character on the complete periodic chart. And I don't know that I've ever done that. Things just kind of stick. You know what I mean? I don't sit down to memorize stuff.
and what you said, though, a lot of that... instead of just flat out memorizing it, you know enough that you can then go look it up. And that's part of learning, that, you know,
that's
you have to memorize everything.
Right. That it isn't all those little bits stick and then there's this jumble of disconnected information. Rather, it's so at one point I got a book called like The Order of Things. And what it is it collects all those hierarchies and sets of things that you always kind of wondered, how does that all tie together? So, you know, here's not only the continents or the longest rivers in the world, it's like, here's the orders of angels. And is a seraphim higher in the order than a cherubim or something like that? And as you browse through this book, and long ago there were like the Wallace brothers had the book of lists. Remember that? And it was like, here's the top 10 Oscar winners. And here's the, right. That kind of thing where it puts a little bit of order to bodies of knowledge. That's very cool to me to have mnemonic devices that come from that. If I'm really trying to remember the ages of man, is there a thing, it spells out, boyhood or something like that. And that's how you can remember bronze and whatever. So that's very handy to be able to store in your mind that top tickler that you can pull on, and then a whole bunch of stuff pops out. You know what I mean? That's the order of clouds in the sky, or what the staff is. You know, every good boy deserves favor, or all those things that just kind of stay with you. It's very handy.
Yes, and just the fact that you were on Jeopardy. And you've got this other thing that makes it interesting. That gives you something to talk about.
Yeah.
And I also know you're a huge music lover.
Absolutely. As are you. Exactly.
Yes. I've actually played bass professionally in various bands. I worked on a cruise ship for a while.
Wonderful.
So what's the latest, whatever that you're listening to no concerts lately.
Actually, so I really like progressive rock, and that's a big term for like lots of keyboards, quite complex, often bombastic, but I like music where it's not only three chord rock and verse, chorus, verse. I like where there's something more to it, maybe a little bit longer songs and deeper lyrics and whatever else it might be. So one of the tragedies of this coronavirus thing that we're going through is that my wife and I have been on a thing called the Cruise to the Edge. It's a big cruise that has all kinds of progressive rock space. It's based on this album called Close to the Edge by Yes, and they're the featured act and kind of the organizers for it and stuff. So you get to see like 3-4 dozen acts in the course of 5 days, and it's just heaven. Well, cruise ships kind of came huge petri dishes for this terrible thing we're going through. And so ours got, canceled / postponed. They're still trying to reschedule it into next year, maybe even, 2022 instead of 21. We'll see. But from that, not only I get to see groups that I've always really liked, and so this one's going to have Yes and Steve Hackett and, Focus, who did Hocus Pocus long ago. And I'll tell you, that to see that live, when you really thought, they're not touring, they're kind of on a holiday, how are they going to make it across the United States? Well, this is the kind of cruise that will help you rediscover Nectar and Saga and Focus and all these, not only older groups that I always wanted to see them and now I finally get it, but there really is cool new stuff going on. So the latest Tool album is really great. The latest Haken, the latest, you know what I mean? It's, I'm always kind of looking for what's available on Amazon. I go to like the Record Den, which is over in off of Euclid Avenue in the eastern suburbs. And often when I go there, it's like somebody just died and this is their estate sale because they have a lot of music that is to my taste. And I don't get out of there without spending like $100 or $100s at $5, $6, $7 a CD. But it's like, wow, I've never seen this before. If I don't buy it now, I might not see it again.
And a lot of that stuff, and even though they've got Spotify and everything else, a lot of that stuff isn't on there yet.
That's right, too.
A lot of bands will have things from the last 10 or 15 years, but then their old catalog, 2 or 3 decades before that, they don't have.
Yeah.
And you never know when some contract runs out and then it disappears.
Boy, is that true.
I keep telling the kids, I'm like, that's why I buy CDs.
Yeah.
I always have it.
I have many. In fact, I just got Yes Songs, which is a 2 CD, used to be 3 album, 3 LP live set. And Colleen said, how have we not had this before? This is like the best of Yes from that period, like middle 70s. Well, I think it was one of those where it wasn't available for a while. They must have been some contract dispute, or maybe, I don't know, somehow I never had it, even though I have pretty much every other Yes thing. I had Yes Shows, which is a later live one. Well, that of, you get to return to this thing you've always loved. And what I've always loved is not to listen to the music. I love the liner notes. I love reading about who's playing what and what equipment they're using. And you can read the lyrics. Oftentimes, progressive rock is a little more opaque than regular stuff, and so you kind of have to, one of the shining, flying purple wolfhounds, who writes that? How would I have figured that out from trying to listen to it? Well, so that's, I still enjoy the LP and now the CD experience, and even though digital is available, there's only certain things that I bought digital because they just weren't going to come out. They hadn't come out in 20 years, and finally I had to have Intergalactic Touring Band. You know what I mean? I just miss listening to it so much. And I don't really pull out my turntable anymore. I listen to everything on digitized CDs, and I just had to have it. So anyway, that's I don't know if that answered the direct question of what am I listening to lately,
except chatting.
A couple new things. Yeah. In fact, I know that you are much more into the world of country than I am, and so that's what I'm looking for to you is give me some stuff as to what should I be listening to, because instead of it being, I find it sane, and I don't, there it's not like complex enough for me, but I know that there's still beautiful stuff. There's still emotional stuff. And that's what I'm kind of looking for. Is one of the joys of being a smarty is you have relatively informed taste and opinion. And so when you ask someone, what's your favorite stuff? If someone's listened to 10,000 CDs, I trust their judgment more than I trust they listen to this one thing obsessively. You know
right,
what I mean?
Right.
So let's make sure we get some of that in there for you. You know,
my interests definitely are all over the board music wise. Cause I studied music in school, listened to a lot, played in jazz bands. So literally if I have certain playlists and mixes, it'll be Miles Davis and then it'll be Bare Naked Ladies and then it'll be Prong. Then Led Zeppelin or something, and it's just literally I'll go all over the board. There are days I just put on Rachmaninoff and I'll listen to something from him for hours.
Yeah.
So it is all my favorite, and everyone rolls their eyes, but I love the 80s pop, especially hair bands, and people are like, well, that stuff's crap. I just enjoy listening to it. And so two of my favorite bands, Rush and Def Leppard, have been like re-releasing everything.
Yes.
And it's like, man, I already have that, but boy, I don't have that new LP with the new notes and, you know, all the time.
See, boy, they saw me coming long ago. I have so many albums where it's the original album plus two cuts because they were doing this in the studio and then it was only played live. And so it's like, am I really going to spend the money again to get two more songs? Well, if it's Rush, if it's Queen, if it's Kansas, then yes, I do. Because I'm enough of a completist that I want to have everything these guys have ever done. You know,
so. I still go to yard sales looking for Pink Floyd's Animals on 8-track because there's a song on there that they didn't release anywhere else. So
I had no idea about that.
Yeah, there's something on that 8-track. And I've been looking for it forever. They may have released it since then.
Okay.
But it's like having the original. I'll look it up. I'll look it up and see what that was.
Very cool.
Because Rush is that way with one of their live, one of their early live ones. The LP had a song on it that they actually cut off for the CD version.
See, I've seen that where the LP was longer. Like Kansas has two for the show. And that on the CD, they cut off things that they couldn't fit up from the LP, and then finally they re-released it after, I don't know, compression technology got better or something like that. And it's like, wow, having heard it on LP, every time that I listen to it on the CD, it's like, no, what comes next is Lonely Wind. And where is it? You know, that kind of thing.
Right. So. And lately, Bare Naked Ladies, another of my favorites, they've been doing weekly like virus jams online, and every week do a song live over their, everybody's at their own homes, but then when you view it, you know, they get paid so much money and they're donating that money to different charities.
That's
so,
very cool. That's one of those, I have certain friends to really thank for, like Paul Garibaldi introduced me to Rush and I'll never be able to thank him enough. And I've got a friend named Dave Addis that introduced me to Bare Naked Ladies. And early on when it was like Gordon, the first album was out. And so ever since I've been a fan of theirs, and then to see, well, they're a little bit like a novelty act because their songs are funny, but they're so musically accomplished and they managed to still capture like radio airplay, lightning in a bottle. So they didn't just go off into obscurity of Dr. Demento famous, but not world famous, that they actually are a big thing. And when we've seen them live, they're one of the best live acts I've seen. They're fantastically good.
Bare Naked Ladies and Weird Al, best concerts I've ever been to.
Absolutely.
And the first time I saw Bare Naked Ladies, the opening band was Cowboy Mouth.
Okay.
And I'd never heard of them. I'm like, hey, this is pretty good music. Yeah. It's enjoyable. And like the last song they were playing, these stage hands came walking out of the back on the stage. I'm like, oh, great. These guys are like, come on, get off of the stage. We got to pick stuff up. Well, the stage hands walk out and they pick up instruments and start playing with the opening band. I'm like, that's pretty cool. I'm looking, wait a second. That's Bare Naked Ladies.
That's Bare Naked Ladies.
The opening band. And I was like, I love these guys just from that. You know, that
exactly.
Like, they just went out and jammed and had a good time.
Helped their new bands. Yeah. I was once at the Milwaukee Summerfest, and they were great with how many great acts they had. And because I lived in Chicago for a long time, they were, you know, an easy drive. And I went up one time to see George Thorogood, who I really love, and he really was great, blew it away. And then the next stage over was Weird Al Yankovic, and I liked him, but I went over there and, like, he blew George Thorogood away. And that's not an easy thing to say, because I really, really like that perfect, like, gut bucket bar George Thorogood thing. And yet Weird Al, with all of his videos and costume changes and the whole integration of, like, his band is so talented, they can play anything and everything. And so when they stretch out, they don't usually stretch out, but they're so perfect in what they do to recreate all these very different musical styles. It was like a memorably great, one of those things where you go out saying, everybody, you got to go see Weird Al when they're in your town. Because I couldn't believe how good they were.
Nobody puts more energy into a show than Weird Al.
Absolutely.
New costumes almost every song. He's always running around. And they add little things to the concert that's not available out on albums. They put mashups together. They extend things. They do these little rap things in between stuff. Bare Naked Ladies does the same type of stuff.
Exactly.
The first show I took my kids to see of his, he jumped on the chair right in front of my daughter and was dancing and singing. And I thought her jaw was going to break. It fell down so fast. She's like, ah. Similar thing, the last time we saw him, he was doing the fancy remake song.
Yes.
And he walked right in front of us. And both my kids were like, oh, my God, I felt his breath. You know, and it was just they loved it. And I'm glad they got to go see him, because my son, I've taken him to several concerts. He doesn't really care for Kiss, but he's seen them in concert, so he can say that.
Yeah.
One of the first concerts I ever took him to was Styx, Poison, and Def Leppard.
Boy, that's a great threesome. Okay, exactly.
It was the day.
Poison, the least of the three to me, but
I like Poison because it's a lot of energy.
Yeah.
You know, that's one of the things I like about them.
Yeah.
So, but that's
one of the joyful things about going to a lesser-known band is that we've been to any number of concerts where people are there just because they wanted to go out that night. And they're taking a break to walk in front of you to go to the bathroom and get another beer or whatever else it might be. But when you're at a Weird Al show, everyone is listening and singing along with every single song. And they're wearing their Hawaiian shirts. And they're just so happy to be there. And the band, you know, there's a wonderful symbiosis of the band feeding off the energy and the audience back. And it's just, it's really...
And the age range.
Yes.
I've seen kids like 6 years old, and I've seen old ladies with walkers.
That's right.
Going to see the show. And the first time I saw Weird Al was like at the State Theater. So it was indoors. It was a nice little theater. And this like 90-year-old lady with a walker is going down the aisle. She goes all the way up to the front row. I'm like, there's a fan, man. Let me tell you.
Absolutely. That's great.
Yeah. And the little kid in front of me, he had the newest album. That's all the songs he knew. He didn't know anything else, you know. But you know, it's funny too, because the last two albums he did were his biggest ones ever, and they're two of my favorites.
Exactly. He hasn't lost a step. I mean, the fact that he has been so consistent for decades is kind of an amazing thing, that he's had such high quality, you know?
He also was one of the first artists I knew that was trying to sell songs individually on his website before compiling them into an album. So the one album you could buy from his website, individual songs as he wrote them before the album came out.
Yeah.
You know, so smart
one of the
man.
Things that I love is box sets, because that's often where you'll get the rarities and the B-sides and the live cuts and all that kind of stuff. And I have his first one, which is called Permanent Record. And so when I want to know that I'm going to get like hours of good music, I just put it on and listen to CDs 1 through 4. Well, I don't have the box set that he released that's in a case shaped like an accordion.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that was, I did get it when it first came out. Now it's probably collector's prices. And I don't know. Yeah. I feel foolish spending hundreds and hundreds of dollars on stuff that I probably already have. And that, you know what I mean? I really love his material, but, and yet it's a fetishy, I want this. I want to have that in my collection. So eventually I will. You know, when I have money that I don't know what to do with, I'm going to find it.
I do have sitting over here my Weird Al Funko Pops.
Okay, exactly.
But yeah, I know the accordion looking box set. It was on my list also.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Anything else, Al? Bring up.
So honestly, it. I think we've done lots of intro as to who we are and how we came to be here and stuff like that.
Yeah, we just kind of went off.
Exactly that. No, let's do this for our first one. You okay with that, Stephen? I'm so happy to be here with you, man. This is a wonderful idea. This is very
cool. So the fear is, do you think we could find enough to talk about next week? I mean, that's a week away.
Remember that outline? We got at least 3 pages that will turn into 40 as we just start jotting down. We can do, as you know, a whole show on 50 different topics without even trying.
Yep.
And I think not only because you and I are into it, other people hopefully will enjoy this too. And let's see.
Well, I'll give you an update. Well, I'll make this the ongoing thing at the moment, maybe. Okay. I've pulled out my Raspberry Pi. Okay. If anyone doesn't know, it's a single computer board, really tiny, fairly low price. Yeah. It's designed for hobbyists and people to create projects like robots and many, many, many other things. But I pulled out mine and I'm working on learning Python because I have a goal of building trail cams for our forest area. We have 4 acres and 1 acre is almost all forest. And I wanted to make a trail cam because we borrowed one and caught a fox, we caught deer, caught birds.
See, how cool is that? Exactly.
Yeah, I want to program it because there's a database that identifies nature. So I want to be able to have it identify what the animal is and automatically tag
Bobcat
it.
Bobcat crossing. This is a yellow-bellied sapsucker, whatever else it might be.
and something none of the other trail cams have, I'm going to have a board with Bluetooth. So all you got to do is walk up with your phone and it'll automatically download the pictures and stuff when it Bluetooths together. That's none of the other trail cams have that. So it's a fun goal. So there, I'll give you updates weekly.
Wonderful, wonderful. All right. Thanks, Stephen. We'll talk to you in a week.
Thanks, Al. Okay. Talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
You have been listening to the Relentless Geekery Podcast. Come back next week and join Alan and Stephen's conversation on geek topics of the week.